Hello, thank you for joining us today on this podcast at this wonderful occasion. Today, our podcast episode will discuss real estate property, property taxes, and parasitic capitalism. Many property owners are very angry and up in arms nowadays. Well, perhaps not literally up in arms, but there's growing national concern that rising property taxes are issues that need to be fixed and addressed. In fact, one cannot afford to ignore these issues. The stakes are too big. On a national level, we know that the amount of property taxes on single-family homes each year is huge, $328 billion, according to a PR Newswire report. And other major headlines even talk about a property tax reckoning is coming. That's in the housingwire.com. There's also headlines about property tax assessments rising in 2022 and 2023. And that's in deeds.com article. And of course, one cannot help but be affected by the headlines in the New York Daily News, which talks about the fact that New York property owners can no longer afford their property tax system. More than 50 years ago, the late President John F. Kennedy raised his plaintive cry and put forth the following challenge, which ultimately led this country to landing men on the moon. He said, "We need men who can dream of things that never were." Today, his message is still being heard, but this time the rallying cry isn't for trying to launch a rocket and being the first to land on the moon. Today, the cries for men and women who are willing to discuss and to direct their time and attention to addressing the issue of income inequality and world poverty. Two things which some people believe is due to the failures of capitalism. One of the favorite central tenets and pillars of capitalism is the idea of property, more specifically, the private ownership of property. Hello, everyone. And welcome. My name is Dale Newton. I'm the host of the podcast, Parasitic Capitalism, a podcast devoted to things about capitalism by using real estate, intangibles, options, and the capitalist markets to help us understand how capitalism works. Today, I'm pleased to have as my guest a professional who is well known in the Central Florida area and the real estate industry. He's going to tell you a lot about real estate property, and in particular, the appraisal and valuation of real estate property. His name is Tim Wilmack. Tim is a real estate appraiser located in Tampa, Florida. He holds a MAI and SRA designations from the Appraisal Institute. Tim has worked in the assessor's office for the past 25 years, and most recently as the chief appraiser of the Palm Beach Property Assessor's Office this past January. Tim has been involved in appraising real estate for more than 30 years and ad valorem assessments for 20 years. He has testified as an expert witness at appeals hearings, circuit court, and federal court. Tim has worked for both property appraisers' offices and as a property tax consultant. He has won several awards for property tax-related articles, including articles on intangibles and real estate. Not too recently, Tim received a Lifetime Achievement Award, which I hope to hear more about that. Tim is a Florida native. He's a veteran of the United States Navy. Thank you for your service, shipmate. And he's been married to his lovely wife, Yvette, for the past 36 years, and they have two daughters and two grandchildren. Without further ado, welcome, Tim. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Absolutely. Tim, tell us about your backstory. Where and how did you get started in this area? And you might want to start in your childhood days and bring us forward, but tell us about that.
Well, you know, I grew up right here in Tampa, and, you know, it's always been home to me. When I was a restless teenager, I joined the Navy, and I always tell young people that's the best decision I ever made in my life. I spent 4 years. I was very lucky. I was in the Navy when Jimmy Carter was president, mm-hmm. and we were fortunate that we were not at war. So I spent 4 years just sailing around the world on a destroyer, and it was almost like a 4-year pleasure cruise, you know? So of course, course, Dale, you know, I worked my butt off on that ship, but it was a lot of fun. And when I got out, I went to college and right here in Tampa, University of South Florida.
Okay.
Took some real estate courses. And because I was in the Navy, I had the benefit of the VA benefits and the GI Bill and all of that. So I was able to take college courses at a significant discount. Mm-hmm. And also I was able to buy a home. Okay. And with the VA, there's a program of nothing down. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Dale, I started looking for homes near where I went to school. Mm-hmm. And my price range, it sounds ridiculous now, but my price range was about $20,000 to $25,000.
Okay.
And when I would call on realtors, they might help me for maybe a half a day, but if I didn't buy something, they would quickly abandon me because the commission was, you know, not worth their time.
Right.
And so it was very interesting to me because I said to myself, look, I can do that. You know, I could give better customer service than them. And that got me interested in real estate.
Okay.
And I joined a real estate office, Coldwell Banker. I started selling homes. Mm-hmm. And then long story short, I met appraisers on my journey selling homes and said, now that is something interesting to me. And I jumped into the appraisal world and have been there ever since.
Oh, I see. So was there anything in your military background, like Supply Corps or Yeoman or something, that directed you towards business or real estate matters, even back at that time?
Not really. I was a welder on the ship.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing that kind of work, but really didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out of the Navy, and figured it would all fall into place when I went to school. And, you know, but it was really that first brush with buying a house that made me see the opportunity there. And that, that I could certainly do something along those lines. And that's what I did.
Okay. So no real mentors, even during high school and at some college courses. It wasn't until later that appraiser or those contacts kind of came into your life.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Are you currently working on any new or exciting projects at this time? Or are you semi-retired or retired? Or how's that helping?
For the last 5 years, I was the chief appraiser in Palm Beach County. Mm-hmm. And my wife had a very good job here in Tampa. Plus, we have two little grandchildren, and my wife is their sort of nanny. Mm-hmm. So I got a job offer to work in West Palm Beach, and I took it. And that was just too good to turn down. So I literally drove back and forth between here and there for 5 years. I would be there during the week in a little apartment there, mm-hmm. and then come home on weekends. Mm-hmm. So after 5 years of that, my wife and I decided it was time for me to come home. Mm-hmm. And I reached retirement age. So I decided, you know what, I'm just going to retire and I'm going to just dabble in residential real estate. Mm-hmm. And so when I got home in January, I opened up my own little residential appraisal shop, even though I can do commercial and all kinds of stuff like that.
Okay.
I wanted to keep it very low key. And Dale, I've been overwhelmed with work already. It's hard to make it part-time.
Got it.
Because there's just so much work out there. Everybody wants their appraisal yesterday. So, you know, I found out you can't just stick your toe in the water. You know, you're either in or you're out. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So right now I'm in. And
we'll see how that goes. Well, that's good. That's exciting. In terms of real estate, and real estate property and taxes on the professional level, your interest was sparked by being, coming in contact with the commercial appraisers or the residential appraisers when you're trying to buy your first home. Would that be a fair statement?
Really, once I started selling homes,
okay,
I would encounter appraisers when I would sell a house. You'd have to meet them at the house for them to do the appraisal. Mm-hmm. And so I'd go out to this house and my deal is hanging on a thread because my buyers may or may not qualify for the mortgage.
Okay.
And I go to the house to meet the appraiser and here comes somebody in a pair of shorts and they're whistling along their day and they measure the house and they take the pictures and they do their analysis. and they get paid. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, weeks go by and it turns out, oh, my buyer didn't qualify. The whole deal fell through. I didn't get paid. Mm-hmm. The mortgage company obviously doesn't get paid. The mm-hmm. title company doesn't get paid. Nobody got paid except one person. Got the appraiser.
Got it.
And I said, now that's a job for me.
Got it. And
so not only was it out of necessity, I had a young family at the time, mm-hmm. but also just because of the analysis and the fact that you're out in the outside during the day for some parts of the day, and then other times you're behind a computer. It was just a nice mix that I thought was very appealing.
Sure. Okay. And what does the abbreviation MAI and SRA stand for?
Well, the MAI stands for Member of the Appraisal Institute.
Okay.
And that's the highest commercial designation that you can get in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the SRA is Senior Residential Appraiser, and that's the highest residential designation you can get. Those are both awarded by the Appraisal Institute, which is, some would argue, the leading appraisal organization in the country. So I got my SRA way back when I appraised houses. You have to take a series of courses. You have to show your experience through sample work. Mm-hmm. You have to take an exam, and ultimately you have to go under peer review where they look at your work, and then you submit sort of a thesis, what they call a demonstration appraisal, mm-hmm. and then eventually you can earn that designation. So
I see. Okay. What is it about taxes in general? When you look at the history of taxation, and I know I've sent you an article entitled A Brief History of Property Tax, that was published in the Fair and Equitable Journal by Richard Henry Carlson in 2005. Mm-hmm. So what is it about taxes in general in the history of property taxes that listeners should pay careful attention to, and why they're so important?
It's funny because not only did I read that article, but I saw that author speak. Oh, and okay. When he spoke on this exact topic. Mm-hmm. I'm a member of that organization where the article was published. It's called the IAAO.
Okay.
Stands for International Assessing Officers. But when he spoke, he actually dressed in the period for which he was talking about. So when okay. he talked about the pilgrims, it was great. But really what I found fascinating about his research was how far back property taxes go. I mean, he's in the Babylonian period, you know, and so it's always been with us, mm-hmm. and I think it always will. Mm-hmm. You know, from my perspective, the biggest challenge, and even when you look back at the history of property taxes, the biggest challenge is fairness, is equity. How much people should pay, and who should pay, and who should okay. not have to pay. And, okay. you know, in our society right now, for example, we don't tax churches.
Okay.
And our society has deemed that churches should not pay taxes.
Okay.
Some might argue with that, but I can tell you that that takes billions and billions off the tax roll for the value of churches. We've made the same decision about government. We say, you know, we don't tax City Hall mm-hmm. Under the premise that, you can tax City Hall, but they're going to pay the taxes with the money we have to give them. So sure. it doesn't make a lot of sense. But mm-hmm. That's really the biggest issue, Dale, is equity. And mm-hmm. in my career, that has been probably one of the biggest challenges, is ensuring equity across the board for all property owners.
And so for the listeners, how would you define the word equity?
In my world, in property tax, equity is simply that comparable properties are assessed at comparable amounts. Now, I can tell you that's very, very confusing in the state of Florida and other states, because we have three values in the state of Florida. We have market value, which is what we think the property is really worth. Mm-hmm. And then we have assessed value. And assessed value is after you've deducted things like homestead exemption caps
okay.
and exemptions and things like that. And then ultimately you have taxable value, how much value you actually pay taxes on. So from an assessor's viewpoint, market value was what I was most focused on. that's where I wanted to make sure every property on the street was assessed similarly. If one property had a swimming pool, that one should be higher.
Okay.
If one property does not have a garage, that should be a little bit lower. The assessed value, and this is where a lot of taxpayers get confused, because they'll look on the assessor's website and they'll say, my neighbor's paying much less than me. That's not fair. And it's often because that neighbor's lived there for 20 years and they've been capped at an assessed value that cannot exceed some certain amount. In Florida, it's 3% a year. And somebody else moves here from New York, they start from day one, from the purchase price that they paid for the home. So those inequities are set out by the legislature, which obviously I would have no control over. But my goal was to ensure that that market value was correct for everybody, or should I say fair for everybody.
Okay. And then the third valuation was the taxable value. Right. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Which is what they actually pay the 1.5% mill or some sort or tax rate on.
That's right. And in Florida, that percentage of assessed value can range from 1% to 2.5%.
Okay.
So for example, in my market here in Tampa, it's about 2%. Mm-hmm. And it makes it pretty easy for me to calculate the taxes, because if somebody says, you know, my assessment's 500,000, I just multiply 2 times 500,000, and I know their taxes are 20,000, or, you know, 20,000 a year, or whatever they,
okay,
you know, in their case, you know, 10,000 a year. But that's, you know, that's typical around the country, really, that 1% to 2%.
Tim, does it make a difference if the tax authority uses actual dollar amount versus millage rate versus the, what's the third category, percent of the tax rate?
Are
they the same or a little different?
Yeah, they're the same. They use the term millage, and really it's 1 mil per 1,000 in value. But when it really comes down to it, it's just a percentage of the taxable value.
Okay.
And so when they say it's, you know, 10 mils, it's 1% of the value, that kind of thing. So I always just look at it as a percentage.
Going back to the history part, they are using percent of crops that was raised or produced, and or percent of the land. Is that similar to what we're doing nowadays, or we've actually gone much further beyond that?
Yeah, it's now, at least in Florida, the way it's done is market value. What is the value of the land and the buildings? Mm-hmm. Meaning, what would somebody pay for that property in an open market? So it's great for assessors, because I would much rather work where I'm doing the same thing that the appraiser's doing to the bank. Mm-hmm. If somebody's trying to get a loan, we're all seeking the same value, market value. Now, what happens after that, that's up to the legislature and voters. If they want to grant a $50,000 exemption if somebody lives in their home, as they do in Florida, mm-hmm. You know, that's certainly not my call. We simply implement that. But from a market value standpoint, we're simply seeking what somebody would be willing to pay for the property.
Okay. Now, property taxes are one of the primary resources that counties and cities use to support themselves and to provide public services. Are you aware of any U.S. Major cities or counties that have gone into bankruptcy or have disappeared because of failure to raise enough revenue dollars from taxes?
You know, I'm not aware of that. Again, I'm sort of an expert in Florida property tax. And in Florida, they have mechanisms built into the law where counties that are underfunded get supported by the state.
Okay.
So, you know, for example, in the state of Florida, you get a significant property tax reduction if you grow crops, if you're a farmer.
Okay.
They call that an agricultural classification. Well, there's some parts of the state where the entire county is farming. So they're just not generating enough revenue to pay for schools and roads and things like that. And so the state has a legal mechanism to where rich counties like Hillsborough and Miami-Dade and Broward and Palm Beach, they would sort of subsidize that gap for those those counties that can't hit that mark.
I see. Okay. What is an appraisal?
An appraisal is essentially an estimate of value by somebody like me. And in the state of Florida, in order for somebody to do an appraisal, they have to be licensed under the state Florida Department of Professional Regulation. And that's an appraisal.
And what is an opinion of value? Is that part of an appraisal, or is that just
the— That's really the punchline in the appraisal, isn't it? I mean, that's the estimate of value that the appraiser's coming in at. Mm-hmm. Now, other people besides appraisers can estimate a value. For example, you may call a realtor to sell your home, mm-hmm. and they will come in with what they call a competitive market analysis, okay. and they'll show sales in your neighborhood. And essentially, they're doing the same thing I'm doing as an appraiser. Mm-hmm. The difference is they're seeking an asking price.
Okay.
So theirs may not even be market value, because they're going to start out maybe above market value.
Okay.
But that's a lot of people, you know, you have insurance companies who send out inspectors mm-hmm. to estimate damages after a fire. Mm-hmm. They may not be seeking market value. That may be insurable value. So, you know, there's different types of values. Mm-hmm. And as an appraiser, you know, that's the first thing I want to know is what value do you seek? And that's part of my assignment.
That's interesting. Now, can you tell me why it appears to be that when you do an appraisal, say commercial property, and there's a business on that property that's operating, you, correct me if I'm wrong, you take into account the business and the income generated that by that business. And the business may have intangible property or intangible assets. But when it comes to residential property, it seems like that there is no recognition of any type of intangible, even though there may be a home-based business there. Can you help us understand that difference?
Absolutely. What it boils down to is, as an appraiser, you're going to estimate value the same way that the market estimates value. So when I appraise a home, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put myself in the shoes of a buyer.
Okay.
And what a buyer is going to do is he's going to look at other sales up and down that street to determine what price they should pay. Mm-hmm. And they may make adjustments. They may be on paper. They may be mental. They may even be subconscious by making adjustments for differences in size and in location, number of bedrooms and baths. And that's the same thing that an appraiser does. I'm replicating the market. Okay. Now, there might be homes in that neighborhood that are rented mm-hmm. where you could do an income approach.
Okay.
But the fact is, the vast majority of the market uses the sales comparison approach when they value homes. So that's what an appraiser does, even though you could apply an income approach. And it gets into a little inside baseball in appraising, but it boils down to highest and best use, and there's some other tests you apply. Now, when you jump over to commercial properties, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to value this hotel the way the market does. And how does the market value it? They might look at some sales of hotels, mm-hmm. but in reality, they're going to look at the income that that hotel generates. And with hotels, you have a building and a piece of land mm-hmm. wrapped together with a business. Mm-hmm. That building is no good without the business. That business is no good without the building. They are intertwined mm-hmm. and together they make each other successful. So as an appraiser, I have to value that entire entity, what they often call a going concern. Mm-hmm. And then I have to make allocations for real estate, which mm-hmm. is the land and the building, personal property, which might be all the stuff in the kitchen and the beds and the dressers, and then intangible value. Things like the value of the Marriott name mm-hmm. or the management that has achieved above average room rates. So those are techniques that appraisers use to make sure that at the end of the day, they only value the real estate there. And that's why commercial can be much more complicated than residential. I appraised a house in the last 2 days I've been working on. Dale, I got 4 sales on the same street.
Okay.
I could throw a rock from the subject property to all four sales. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get the value of that property wrong if I tried.
Okay.
You know, I'm overwhelmed with information. Mm-hmm. These are all very similar properties. And even if there was a business in that property going on, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter to me because I'm not including it in my valuation. I'm only valuing it based on sales of other buildings and land.
I see. Now, going back to this approach, this logic and reasoning, if you take 123 Main Street, the house located there, 2,000 square feet, 1 acre lot, a cash buyer would like to purchase it from, say, you for $300,000. If you take that same identical house, same square size building and lot, and you put it in the worst part of town, you would expect that to have a different appraisal value than its current location. And if you take that same identical house and situation and put it on the golf course or the beach, you'd expect it to have a different value or cash that it could command, either cash purchase, all cash, or mortgage, whatever. So my question suggests to me, logic would say that the location of the property is a key factor that determines the intangible value that should be attached to that property. Does that type of logic and reasoning come into your thinking process, or do you tend to focus only on those four or five houses or that 2 mile radius where recent comps have sold?
Right. Well, location is it gets a little bit confusing when you start talking about tangible and intangible. There's right. intangible attributes mm-hmm. that cause the tangible value to be worth more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for example, in your example, I have a house in a terrible location. Let's say it's on a busy highway.
Okay.
I got the same exact house on the beach mm-hmm. with an oceanfront view. Well, my oceanfront view is intangible, right? I can't right. grab it.
Right.
But even though it's an intangible asset, I'm sorry, an intangible attribute, mm-hmm. it is not an intangible asset. I do not own that view separate from the real estate. Okay. That view is entangled with the age of the home, all the attributes that make that property valuable. Or put another way, Dale, if you own that beachfront home, mm-hmm. you couldn't say to me, Tim, I'll sell you the house, but I'm not going to sell you the view. You can't have the view.
Okay.
You can't withhold the view. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. there, right?
Right.
So that's the distinction I make. To me, location is sort of an intangible attribute, kind of, mm-hmm. but it's a tangible factor in the appraisal of real estate. It's a piece of the real estate. In fact, the land is the underlying foundation of real estate. And that is certainly tangible, and location would be part of that.
Is intangible value, you talked about allocation, and let's say for a home, for example, is it always a positive number, or can it be zero or even a negative number?
Well, I guess it would be, depend on what you would call intangible, what that intangible asset would be or intangible factor would be. Typically, anytime intangible value has ever come up in my world, it's always a positive aspect that somebody's trying to get removed from the value to lower their property taxes. Okay. It rarely ever comes up in the residential world. I'll give you an example where it could come up, mm-hmm. so you might understand where I might define an intangible with residential. Let's say I'm appraising a condo, and I'm looking at sales of condos in the building.
Okay.
And my unit's 1,000 square feet, and every single 1,000 square foot unit has sold for $250,000. Mm-hmm. Then I see one that has sold for $300,000. And I'm like, wait a minute, they all sold for $250,000 except this one. Mm-hmm. So I call up the broker and I'm like, how is it that this one sold for $300,000 and the others sold for $250,000? And the broker says, well, that's very simple. The buyer wanted that unit because their mother lives next door. Mm-hmm. So any other unit would not suffice. It had to be that unit. And they were willing to outbid anybody else to get it. And so they essentially overpaid so that they could get that unit. Well, what's that difference between the $250 that everybody else pays mm-hmm. and the $300 that he paid? That $50,000 is an intangible value. And if I'm the assessor working on that condo, I'm going to assess all those 1,000 square foot units at $250, including his. Okay. I'm not going to penalize him for something that he's not going to be able to duplicate when he goes to sell. Mm-hmm. If for whatever reason his mother passed away and it's time to sell, he's not getting $300. Mm-hmm. He's going to get $250 like everybody else. So that's an example of an intangible value that should be excluded. And what appraisers often do and should do is when they're reviewing sales, they should ensure that that price only included real estate. And it may not be intangible. It may be that somebody threw a boat in with the deal. The appraiser needs to know that and adjust their sales accordingly.
Okay. Okay. Now, you've got the famous basketball star, his house. It's on the market for $10 million. And the other surrounding houses are much less. But because he's a NBA, you know, all-star player, how do you make that assessment? And how do you make it fair to the other taxpayers who got the same lot size, maybe a couple thousand square feet, smaller house, but still same neighborhood, right? They're only a stone's throw from his house.
Right. Well, great example. And the question would be, for me as an appraiser, mm-hmm. would every buyer, or more importantly, would a typical buyer pay more for that star's house because the star lived there, had lived there? And if the answer is yes, that's real estate value. That property carries a certain something that a typical buyer would pay for. Now, if only NBA fans would pay a little extra, now I've reduced my market greatly.
Sure.
And I got to be careful about assigning any kind of value to that. You run across similar situations like that with historical properties.
Correct. Okay.
And, you know, the Waldorf Hotel, I've used it as an example in New York, where somebody would say, well, we're not going to sell the Waldorf name with the property. We're going to withhold that. Well, you would think that that would keep any historical value out of the value. But the fact is, the world knows that property is the Waldorf. And whether you want to withhold it or not, it carries a certain something that would increase the value.
I see. Okay. I'm going to try and share my screen with you.
Okay.
Do this correctly. I'm going to show you some dates. And I'm going to ask you some questions about these dates and the topic of capitalism. Okay. The screen is showing about five dates. Good. That first date, is the title was Date Chronological Listing, Emergence of Parasitic Capitalism. In 1602, my research shows that the Amsterdam Stock Exchange was founded and derivatives were introduced on that stock exchange in 1607. In 1792, the New York Stock Exchange was founded in this country. And my research shows that property taxes were introduced in the USA in 1796. And by 1800, there are four major stock exchanges in the entire world: London, Paris, Amsterdam, and the USA. And I put in the name Karl Marx being born in 1818. I bring up this slide and these dates because I want to make a claim, and I'm going to rest my claim based upon these dates. And the claim is that, I've got the next slide, if it's working, let me see. Yes, the next slide. My conclusion is in 1796, at least by that date, all of the necessary and sufficient conditions needed for parasitic capitalism to emerge into the world had been established and was in existence and operational. So that's my claim. And where I spend my time and energy and why this podcast is attractive for me to try to host and to explore is to get a better understanding about property taxes and the role of taxes. And this is something that I call parasitic capitalism. Now, I use the word PCAP for short, for parasitic capitalism, but it basically is a new idea. In fact, it's one of 20 possible ideas related to this term and its meaning and its interpretation and use. But for my purposes, I view parasitic capitalism as using real estate, property, intangibles, options, and the capitalist markets as a way to enter a new intellectual space, but also to create another way to understand and explore what capitalism is and what it means. I know I said a mouthful there, but I just want to explain that parasitic capitalism is not really the negative thing that people might think about when they use or hear the phrase parasitic. Mm-hmm. And my research takes me to another level, which is when this is considered, it makes me think about capitalism itself. And we know that property and real property is a crucial tenement or pillar of capitalism. And if I were to place and think about capitalism in the context of making microwavable bag of popcorn, okay? I've shown you a picture now where there's a gentleman who's looking at two microwave ovens. And inside each microwave oven is a bag of popcorn. One oven is labeled capitalism, but the bag of popcorn is called the real world. The other microwave oven is called the real world, and this bag of popcorn is called capitalism. So the question that I have for you, Tim, is that which of these two examples, I assume you know how to cook microwave popcorn, that you may even have and own a microwave oven. Mm-hmm. Which of these two example or scenarios do you think best represents the real world if you're trying to make a perfect, delicious bag of popcorn? And of course, property taxes and property is embedded in whatever system that you're thinking about.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'd have to think about this a little bit more. This is a bit out of my world in praising property taxes, more in the economics world. It's a little bit out of my purview, but so I'm struggling a little bit with how to answer that.
Okay. Well, that's the same situation I am trying to figure out myself. I see it as both a problem and a dilemma. In other words, when we grew up in the US, we know and understand how capitalism seemingly works. We have a understanding intuitively, even as non-economists. And yet when faced with this type of situation, the question becomes, what happens when you introduce a new construct, a new idea? If you create and put a new Lego block on the table, does your understanding and your worldview about capitalism and how it works, is it changed? Is it altered? Or does it make any impact on that? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to show that we know, according to mathematics, we all learned that 2 + 4 = 6. We also learned that 1 + 2 + 3 = 6. Mm-hmm. When you take both those, in mathematics, we're taught that you can find the answer and solve the answer to the problem. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you really struggle, you might go to the back of the book and look for the answer. You shouldn't do that, but we know people have done that. But there's some math problems in some real world situations where there's no straightforward, easy answer. I call that a dilemma. A dilemma is something that doesn't seem to lend itself to a clear solution. And therefore you have to, quote, think outside the box and maybe see things from a different perspective in order to come up with or arrive at a solution. Now, I bring this topic up because when you look at this question and you make the statement, that is, if I make the statement that by 1796, all the necessary and sufficient conditions needed for parasitic capitalism to emerge into the world had been established and was in existence and operational, I make that statement because of the dates I showed earlier. In 1607, there was the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. There were derivatives, put and call derivatives, I believe. And if those had been introduced at that time, then by 1796, there could have been something that was created called a property tax option, a put and call option. For example, when you appraise real estate and it's a vacant lot, your appraisal value may come in at, say, $500 for that year. Mm-hmm. And the taxes may be, well, maybe, let's say, $2,000 a lot, but the property taxes are $500 that year. But once mm-hmm. the house and the building, commercial building, is built in that lot, invariably, it seems like, from my experience and observation, property taxes go up. Mm-hmm. But I then realized later, that's not necessarily the case in all tax jurisdictions. I understand that in the city of Baltimore, for example, the property taxes on vacant lots tend to be higher. And that once you build on the property and make capital improvements, the property taxes actually are lower that the owner has to pay. It's as if the city commissioner said, we want to address urban blight. We want to reduce criminal activity in this area. We want to incentivize property owners not to keep their property, quote, to attract, you know, to be looked, to appear abandoned, right?
Right.
Fix it up, build it up, make it nice, and we'll lower your property taxes. Mm-hmm. So my question at this point to you, Tim, is, in your experience, is it more often than not that property taxes tend to go up once a building has been constructed or a house has been built, or just the opposite?
Yeah, that's just such an interesting topic. My answer, first of all, is that taxes almost always go up when new buildings are built, almost always. And I say almost because oftentimes government will intervene and they'll say, Amazon, we're going to give you a tremendous discount if you build your warehouse in our little jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And we are going to abate taxes for 10 years if you build that building and bring all those jobs to our county. So, you know, almost always for the average Joe, the taxes are going up. But if you're big enough to, afford to lobby legislatures to give you a tax break, you might be able to avoid that. But generally, it's ironic. And I feel bad because working for the tax assessor for many years, I've fielded phone calls where people have said, look, I bought a junky house. Mm-hmm. And I went in and I put a new roof on it and I painted it and I updated, renovated it. And what'd you guys do? You raised my taxes. I'm making the neighborhood better. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate. I really had tremendous empathy and sympathy for those folks. But what do you do as an assessor? I had to follow the law. Mm-hmm. And at least in Florida, you value what's on the site. And in some cases, if somebody spent a lot of money to make it better, unfortunately, the market value has gone up, and that's what's going to happen to their taxes as well.
Well, Tim, your Lifetime Achievement Award, was that something that you were surprised by or expecting? Or tell us about that.
I was shocked. I did not expect that. And I I won that after I had retired. So it was several months after I had long left property tax that I was notified about that. But I knew then that I was officially old. Because, you know, that was the number one qualification for lifetime achievement.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, just to prepare to wrap things up, my other interesting insight was the article you sent me that you wrote and published in 2014, I think. And it talked about the ad valorem, I think a brief history of ad valorem taxation, if I remember correctly. And I was really impressed by the amount of time and energy you spent in researching all those legal cases. That must have taken quite a bit of effort, but it certainly has helped my research in terms of helping direct my thinking and looking in those areas.
Well, why I did that, Dale, is in my role working for the assessor's office, I often manage very complex commercial properties where taxpayers would hire attorneys and experts to come in and say, hey, you have my hotel assessed at $100 million, but it should be $60 million because $40 million of it is intangible and you can't assess that. So I really had to know my stuff in dealing with those cases. And so, you know, I slowly would accumulate court cases on the topic and then decided, you know what, I'm going to have some fun. I'm going to go back and see how far back this issue goes. And I'm not an attorney, but we had a law library, a public law library, a block from my office. And so I would go there every day for lunch. And they had a public machine. They had one computer for the public. And there was a program on there called LexisNexis. And you could type in anything you want. You know, you could type in NBA player and spaghetti. I mean, if there's ever been a case about that, that would come up. And so I just typed in intangibles and literally 100,000 cases would come up. And I'd have to try to narrow it down with keywords. And, you know, little by little, I whittled it down to the ones that I found most interesting. And I tried in the article, I hope it was obvious, to include cases on both sides of the issue. Folks that argued that, you know, intangibles are unfairly included in certain cases like hotels. And really, a lot of it was about the techniques for allocating intangibles and how that's evolved over the years. But yeah, that was a fun article.
That's great. I look forward to you doing more writing and contributing to the literature. I think one of the things that surprised me reading the research that I've come across, and of course, reading your article, was, just as you mentioned earlier, how far back property taxes go. All the way back to the time of Jesus Christ. The author, Mr. Carlson, had mentioned that property taxes were actually something that were, that the right to collect the property taxes was granted and sold by the state to private citizens.
Yeah, in other words,
the state was creating and selling an intangible property right to private citizens that's not attached to the land per se. And so that was a nice little nugget for me to think about when I came across that article and realizing that, yes, once you split or separate the intangible from the tangible, those intangible rights do have value. They have meaning. In fact, it appears that the state back in the Roman days, they would have auctions every so often and auction off the right for private citizens to collect the taxes on behalf of the empire. Just fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned in my intro that I worked as a property tax consultant.
Yes.
So not only did I work for the assessor, but I worked on behalf of taxpayers to try to help them get their taxes lowered. And I had a fascinating case that was directly involved with intangibles. And it's over in your neck of the woods. It was the Lowe's Universal Hotel.
Okay.
On Universal Studios property. And I'm not sure about today, but back when I did the case, if you stayed overnight in the Lowe's Universal Hotel, not only did you get your room, but you also got something called a fast pass, that would get you to the front of the line in the theme park.
Wow.
Now, you didn't pay extra for that. That was part of your room fee. And the room fee was not cheap. It was about $300 a night.
Okay.
And when I worked for that taxpayer for Loews Hotels, I argued to the assessor that the room rate was inflated due to the inclusion of that fast pass. Mm-hmm. And that that fast pass was an intangible that should, that the benefits of the revenue from the fast pass was an intangible that shouldn't be included. And that if that hotel didn't offer that little perk, the room rate might be more like $200 a night. So there's a million examples of intangibles, and I did prevail in that.
Okay.
And I think rightly so, because if you and I decided to buy that hotel today, we would not be able to make that same offer unless we came to an agreement with the Universal Studios folks, which would obviously cost us a lot of money.
Correct.
You know, so that's an example of an intangible that, you know, and really there was a lot of, that was the easy part of the case. The hard part was how to separate that value.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a fun one.
Well, I don't know if Burns Steakhouse is still open or not. I know you alluded to that in your article. Good. Okay.
Yep.
So that's a great tradition. As we wrap things up, are there any takeaway messages that you'd like to leave with our listeners? And if my listeners have questions that they'd like to follow up and ask you about on anything they've heard, is there a good contact way for them to reach you?
Yep. The easiest way to reach me is just my name, timwilmath@gmail.com. And okay. Anybody's welcome to email me anytime. And it's timwilmath@gmail.com. And as far as takeaway, Dales, you know, you and I have talked a lot about the market value and the assessment side of property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's unfortunately, taxpayers don't have a lot of control over that. You know, that house I did the last couple of days with four sales on the same street, I am 99.9% confident in my value.
Okay.
And a taxpayer would have very little ability to fight that. But there's another component to taxes, and that's the tax rate. And that is not set by the property appraiser. That is set by your local governments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you do have input. In Florida, they're required to hold public hearings when they set those rates. And that directly influences your taxes. And I always get very disappointed when we are in a period of rising values like we are right now, and you do not see these local officials lowering that tax rate to offset that increase in value. In fact, you'll see headlines like Orange County holds the line on taxes because they didn't raise the rate. But truly, they should lower the rate because they're raising taxes if they do nothing. So my last word would be get involved, go to those meetings, because when nobody shows up, they get the green light to do whatever they want. And in my experience, like back in the Great Recession, people would come out to those meetings and I would literally watch them lower the rate as people walked up to the podium and said their piece. So get involved. That would be my last word.
Sounds great. Good. I look forward to having a follow-up conversation with you, Tim, at some time in the future, and we will continue with our dialogue. I thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to have you on the show.
Thank you, Dale. It was my pleasure.
That's our show for today, folks, and thank you for listening to today's episode. I look forward to your continued support, and I hope that you'll subscribe to our podcast on either Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. If you have any questions for any of our guests or me about anything that you've heard on the show, please feel free to drop me a short email and we'll try to get back to you. I can be reached at dale@pcapitalism.com.